What a disappointment this century has been. We have seen in every country a dissolution, a weakening of those bonds, a challenge to those principles, decay of faith, an abridgment of hope, on which structure and ultimate existence of civilized society depends. We have seen in every part of the globe one great country after another, which had erected an orderly, peaceful, and prosperous structure of civilized society, relapsing in hideous succession into bankruptcy, barbarism, or anarchy. Can you doubt, my faithful friends, as you survey this somber panorama, that mankind is passing through a period marked not only by an enormous destruction and abridgment of human species, not only by a vast impoverishment and reduction in means of existence, but also the destructive tendencies have not yet run their course, and only intense, concerted, and prolonged efforts among all nations can avert further and perhaps even greater calamities. Tom Holland, who is that?
Well, it's not Liam Neeson.
It's not. You know perfectly well who that is. That is.
I think, considering the amount of grief you gave me over my really very, very good impersonation of Liam Neeson, if you're telling me that that was Churchill.
That was Winston Churchill.
I will believe you.
The electors of Dundee in 1922. Give me my Dundee cake. Where is my Dundee cake?
And he came forth, didn't he?
He did come forth. He came forth and he was beaten by a man called Edwin Scrimgeour, who is the only person ever to have won a seat in Parliament standing for the Scottish Prohibition Party.
So what, banning alcohol?
Yeah, so that tells you just how highly the Scottish voters thought of Winston Churchill. They were prepared to elevate Mr. Scrimgeour in his place.
Well, the Scots have a long history of banning things that are fun.
They do. Christmas. They didn't do Christmas, yeah, as we discovered.
Well, and Hogmanay this year.
Yeah, well, yes, that's true. So yes, we're in 1922, aren't we? We shall come back to Churchill in a little bit. I probably won't do another impersonation, but that gives you
a flavour. You're back in 1922, yeah. Standing on the streets of Dundee.
A flavour of what was lost to the world.
Are you telling me that wasn't actually audio footage?
When I was so cruelly denied the part of Paddington, as regular listeners will know. Well,
Dominic.
Yeah.
On that theme, could I just interrupt at this point? Because people who've listened to a lot of the podcasts will know that you missed out on the chance to play Paddington.
Yeah.
Because this was on the back of... So the director of Paddington directed you in Edinburgh.
He did. Did he not? In the mid-1990s. Playing Thomas Beckett.
In Jean-Henri's play Beckett.
Yeah.
And the Scotsman came to see it, is that right?
It gave us 2 stars. I think it was out of 5.
Well, Dominic.
Yeah.
And at this point, I just have to print off the review. Hold on.
Oh, no, you're kidding me.
Did he say 2 stars, Dominic?
They did.
Did he say the Scotsman gave you 2 stars?
I believe they gave us 2 stars out of 5, didn't they?
No. No, they didn't. And I'll tell you how I know this. Because Rebecca Stubbs, friend of the show.
Yes.
Keen listener. Someone who very generously sponsored me to show her and her family around Rome and London in aid of my benefit year. She informed me just a couple of days ago that her husband was the producer of that show. He's kept the review.
Well, must have been good then if he kept it.
Which I can now read.
Please do.
And Dominic, I'm afraid the Scotsman only gave you a single star.
Oh, 1 star. And I thought
gave
it
gave you 1 star. In years to come, the cast of Henri's Beckett will regale dinner guests about their opening night at the 1995 Fringe.
Well, I do.
They will tell of the stumbled lines, fumbled set changes, creaking chairs, creaking floors, creaking dialogue.
Well, the dialogue's not happening. I mean, that's Jean-Henri's fault, surely.
of the guitar that appeared in the third act, only to resound again as it hit the floor off stage in the fifth, of the tourist who wandered in through an exit, followed 10 minutes later by a mime artiste in full makeup, Becket is a complex play about conflict between Henry II and Thomas of Becket, between church and state, Norman and Saxon, honour and duty. And this is the line that you remember. Teenage bishops in trainers rarely convey the authority of the church. Acting styles from Brando to Hoffman to Woody Allen work against intellectual cohesion.
I think I was probably Brando.
A powerful performance from the central character of Henry II.
Oh, come on.
Could not rescue the play and only threw it off balance. He's a young man well endowed in many respects, but cannot be named since the programme gives no cast list. The age-old conflict between valour and discretion, perhaps. The companies are from various universities and will no doubt become lawyers, doctors, scientists, journalists, but not, I venture, actors.
Oh, dear.
That was Douglas Young for The Scotsman. And he was right, well, wasn't he? Because you didn't become an actor.
I didn't become an actor, but I don't think he really got it.
The whole brilliant kind of subtle riff with the tourist, yeah, and the guitar falling and the trainers.
To be fair, I think a lot of people would now say Scottish arts criticism was going through quite dark days in the mid
1990s. Yeah, well, or it's like Virginia Woolf, isn't it? Or indeed The Sporting Life on Ulysses.
Yeah,
didn't get the point. Anyway, listen, we've blown massively off course there. What were we talking about? I can't remember.
We're about to talk about 1922. Yes. So yesterday, when Tom Holland wasn't reading out disobliging reviews of top actors, we were talking about 1922, about modernism, about Bolshevism, the birth of Italian fascism, and so on. And I mean, obviously, one thing that was completely missing from yesterday's podcast, apart from you reading out ridiculously ill-judged notices in Scottish newspapers, was America.
Yeah.
And in a weird way, America is politically
kind of impotent, isn't it?
It is. It's kind of turned inwards. It's not joined the League of Nations. So the president,
which was an American initiative,
Woodrow Wilson, but basically the other Americans don't want to join it. So they've rejected his idea. The president is now a man called Warren Harding, who is just very bland and boring Republican. He's a bit corrupt. I mean, his big thing is he promises a return to normalcy after the.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's a man who basically makes no impact at all on the international stage. And that's partly by design, because America is obviously isolationist in the 20s. And actually the things that, looking from outside, are really striking is obviously prohibition. I mean, we mentioned Churchill mm-hmm. losing. So prohibition has been underway since the beginning of the decade. And also the support for the Ku Klux Klan, which is extraordinary. So the Ku Klux Klan has revived after D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. And in the sort of, I mean, we talked yesterday about the sort of paramilitary violence of the early 20s. And I think the Klan is America's equivalent of that. So it's got about 1 million members.
Right. So that's massively influenced by a Hollywood film.
Yeah. And film, I suppose, is the big thing, isn't it?
I mean, and I guess what you'd say is that America is maybe politically, you know, it's retreated from the stage. But this is the age where popular culture... It's America is for the first time absolutely the popular flavor of the month.
I think
so. This is the jazz age.
Yeah, you get the talk of Americanization. Hollywood. People are talking about the Americanization of the world, and Hollywood, as you say. So it's interesting, actually, when you look at 1922. Three very significant firsts. Well, I mean, there are lots of significant firsts, but one of Charlie Chaplin moves into feature films from doing the short films he'd done.
Chaplin
earlier.
Is the most famous man in the world, isn't he? At this time.
He probably is. Yeah, I think he probably is. So he has joined up with Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford to form their own kind of studio. He wants to move into serious feature films, but you also have Walt Disney doing his first animated films. And Hitchcock in England. So Hitchcock does a film called Number 13 that is now completely lost. But you see...
Disney is probably the biggest of those. Disney is the... It's the huge thing.
Because Little
Red Riding Hood is the first, but you've got Cinderella coming
at the
end of the year. And also you've got the kind of the escalating expense on blockbusters. So you mentioned Griffiths, who then from Birth of a Nation went on to make Intolerance. But then Intolerance gets lapped in this year by Robin Hood, made by...
that's Douglas Fairbanks, isn't it?
By Douglas Fairbanks, which is the most, by far the most expensive film.
Almost
I've
one
made.
And a half million dollars, I think. And you
and
know,
makes it back.
a fascinating thing about but Robin Hood is the first film to be given a proper Los Angeles premiere, and the name of the, do you know the name of the cinema, Tom? It would appeal to you because it would allow you to talk about something that you, I know you're very interested in.
Oh, what?
The cinema is Grauman's Egyptian Theater. And interestingly, that is a month before something very close to your heart.
Discovers, yeah. Which is, in a way, I mean, purely as a news story. So as something to get people talking that isn't, you know, about high politics or whatever. You'd say the biggest of the kind of those kind of news stories, possibly of the century, happens in 1922, which is the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun.
Yeah, the biggest news story of the century. That's a very big claim.
So it established. So craze is a word that is first used in the 20s. Archetype of the craze is kind of Tutmania, which is generated by discovery by Howard Carter in November 1922. Of the first and only intact pharaonic tomb ever to be found. So full of wonderful things, as Carter didn't actually say, but his ghostwriter made him say. So, we talked about this in the Akhenaten episode, but it's an incredible story. Carter had been toiling away for years and years and years on behalf of his patron, Lord Carnarvon. And he goes into the summer of 1920, the digging season of 1922, and it's the last chance saloon. You know, Carnarvon's going to withdraw the funding after this. And on the 4th of November, they discover a step. And Carter's been looking for Tutankhamun's tomb. And they clear away the step. And by the 6th of November, it's clear that Carter has discovered what he has been looking for. And, of course, he can't go straight in. He has to wait for Lord Carnarvon. And he wires Lord Carnarvon. And Carnarvon wires back, possibly come soon.
No!
Get here! And Carnarvon very rapidly realizes exactly what it is that Carter's found and what he means. So they zip over. And so 26th of November, they enter the tomb. You know, can you see things? Wonderful things. A gleam of gold. They know that they've found it. And on the 30th of November, the news is splashed in the Times. So it's exclusive for them. And the world goes mad for it.
Yeah, in his book we were talking about last time, Constellation of Genius, Kevin Jackson's book about the events of 1922, doesn't he say that the opening of Tutankhamun's tomb is basically the first mass media world event?
That's what I was struggling to articulate.
Yeah. And I suppose it does start this sort of Egyptian mania, doesn't it? And I suppose it also, what it reflects, though, is that technologically you can have mass media world events.
Absolutely, yes. And you know who gets elbowed out of it?
I don't.
From the press coverage, is a guy called Arthur Eagle, who is being employed by the Daily Mail.
Wow. The newspaper that we discovered last time created modernism. Mm.
Yes, but also the Daily Mail creates the legend of the curse, because Arthur Eagle is so furious at not being allowed, you know, exclusive access to the tomb, that he comes up with this idea that after Lord Carnarvon dies, that he's been felled by the curse. So another triumph for...
Well, you know what also the Daily Mail also created, which is a huge part of the culture of 1922, and in some ways you could argue the year's most lasting and important legacy, radio.
Right. So tell us about radio, Dominic.
So, you know, people have been experimenting with radio broadcast and whatnot for years. The key person in Britain is a man called Marconi, who set up the Marconi Company, who's obviously an Italian immigrant. And in 1920, he gets sponsorship from the Daily Mail to do the first live entertainment broadcast, which is done by Dame Nellie Melba. She sings a song and the Marconi Company broadcast it. And this is one of their the Daily Mail are hugely into stunts at the beginning of the 20s. So at one point, Lord Northcliffe invents a new hat, for example. And they're always trying all these different wheezes.
Why are they not doing that now?
I think they probably are. I mean, I haven't invented a new hat for them, but, give it time.
Get on with it.
The Marconi Company, they're the real pioneers in Britain of radio. So it's in early 1922. I think it's February, actually. 14th of February,
that you have the first regular broadcasts, which are from a hut, which I've been to, Tom, actually, because I did a documentary about this for the BBC, because this is where the BBC mm-hmm. comes from. There's a hut in a place called Rittle, which is outside the Marconi factory in Chelmsford in Essex, and a man called Peter Eckersley would broadcast on Tuesday evenings for half an hour, and they were the first regular radio broadcasts.
In Britain or in the world?
In Britain. Now, what's happened in America is that you have had this explosion of radio at exactly the same time, but in America it is completely unregulated. So you have kind of maybe 100 radio stations by the spring, and then in the summer you have hundreds of radio stations in America.
Right. So it's like kind of internet startups suddenly.
It's exactly that. So a lot of people have asked questions about, you know, what is the most important invention or discovery that is associated with the sort of modernity of the 20s. So Kevin Douglas asks about broadcasting. Chris Salmon says, which is the most important invention? And I would say the answer is radio, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think what's so interesting about it is in America, it is advertising funded. And there's this explosion of radio stations throughout the summer of 22. There's this sort of sense of chaos and free for all. And in Britain, the people observe this and they say, oh, my God, we can't have anything like this. This mm-hmm. is an absolute sort of, this would be the worst possible thing. And they actually say, you know, it's an anarchy, it's chaos. And of course, that we were talking last time about that the absolute ubiquitous fear of anarchy and of Bolshevism and all this kind of thing, and the thirst for order at the beginning of the 20s. And I sort of wonder whether that's in people's, you know, they have this hatred of disorder and of uncertainty, unsurprisingly after what they've been through. And so the Marconi company And five of the other big companies get together and they want to set up a monopoly licensed by the government, which will be called the British Broadcasting Company. And that's what basically happens.
And that's what happens.
So they get together and by October they have formed what becomes basically the BBC. And the BBC starts its first regular radio broadcasts on the 14th of November 1922. And to listen to them, you need a radio set, which are, I mean, they're not cheap, and you have to pay a 10 shilling license fee. And the license fee.
So right from the beginning, the license fee is there.
The license fee is there right from the beginning. What isn't there right from the beginning is complaining about the license fee, which comes in later.
Right.
But you know who despises the BBC, Tom? Our old friend from the previous episode, Virginia Woolf.
Does she?
She does not believe in, she's horrified by the idea of bringing high culture to the masses. Because she said, look, they won't understand it. It'll destroy her culture. It's
all
right. So Wolf complains at one point that the BBC's first director of talks, who is this pioneering, extraordinary woman called Hilda Matheson, Wolf doesn't like her. She says there are two things wrong with her. One, she's got a wooden face.
Right.
And the other,
Virginia Woolf's face, famously.
Yeah, well, of course. Virginia Woolf of all people. And then Virginia Woolf says the other thing she doesn't like her is that she lives in South Kensington. She regards as middle class, drab, and dreary.
Yeah.
So
she's a cracker.
Yeah, lovely person. So from a British point of view, I would say that's absolutely the most important thing about 22 is that.
Did you read about the first drama broadcast on BBC?
No, go on. Give me.
It went out on Christmas Eve.
Yeah,
and it was called "The Truth About Father Christmas."
Oh my God. So what a thing to put out on Christmas Eve.
I know everyone's put away their Christmas decorations, but a little festive, last final festive touch there. That was the first ever BBC drama.
Does it tell the real, what's it say?
I don't know what it's about. I'm guessing it's the truth about Father Christmas, don't I?
That's probably lost now.
Maybe it's on BBC Sounds with their unfair monopoly.
I don't think there's anything else on BBC Sounds worth listening to, Tom.
Certainly not
history podcasts.
No, just stick to us.
So anyway, 14th of November 22 is the BBC start broadcasting. And you know what happens on the 15th of November, Tom?
No.
General election.
Ah.
Very important general election. But we should come to that in a bit. We should talk about, because Britain is still kind of top nation in the 20s, isn't it?
Well, are we?
Well, this is the question. This is the question.
Because is it not a straw in the wind that a naval conference is held in Washington?
Yeah.
And
fair point.
It's the first attempt at arms control, an arms control treaty.
And well, it's one of the.
But is this in the context of the kind of the dreadnoughts and everything in the arms, the yes, naval absolutely. Race yeah. before the First World War between Britain and Germany? And it's an attempt to try and regulate the size of fleets.
Yeah, it is.
And Japan is kind of starting to muscle in.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's agreed that the balance of power will be Britain 5, US 5, Japan 3. So. Yeah. Equal billing between this. Britain and the United States. And in effect, that draws a line under the many, many centuries of British naval supremacy.
I think you're absolutely right. Because before the First World War, the British, the Royal Navy, had still operated what they called the two-power standard, which was...
But they had to have twice the
yeah, they had
number
to,
of ships of the next two competitors.
Exactly. And that they had to, yeah, exactly, that they had to basically outmatch their two biggest competitors. And... they ditched that, and they, as part of the Washington Naval Treaty, they agreed to scrap 24 ships that they're already planning to build, capital ships. So that's the point at which I think they realize then, you know, they're not the Americans are going to overtake them. Yeah, yeah. They're not going to compete. They're not going to compete in the same way.
And is there is there a sense that that's okay because America is likely to be an ally?
That's a good question. I don't know enough about it to possibly. Possibly. I think there's also a sense, though, of, I mean, they're desperately trying to cut spending at the beginning of the 20s. So Lloyd George's government has had something called the Geddes Axe, which is all about cutting spending, because they've obviously run up absolutely
astronomical debts
to pay for the First World War. And I think there is as you alluded to, there is this really odd paradox that on the one hand, if you look at the map, the British Empire is pretty much at its greatest extent. So there's more pink on the map than ever before or since. But at the same time, there's already this sense of retrenchment.
So, well, and also that the territorial integrity of the United Kingdom, of Great Britain and Ireland, is no more.
Yeah, that's right. And actually that's such a huge part of this story, and something we haven't talked about at all in this podcast since we started it, is Ireland. And we should really go into it because it's such a sort of fascinating and tragic story. Do you think we should take a break before we get to Ireland, Tom?
Or do you think we should? Let's take a break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about Irish independence and the Civil War. What is that sound high in the air, murmur of maternal lamentation? Who are those hooded hordes swarming over endless plains, stumbling in cracked earth, ringed by the flat horizon only? What is the city over the mountains, cracks and reforms and bursts in the violet air, falling towers, Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal? T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland, we talked about in the first part.
You didn't do it in T.S. Eliot's voice, that's all I'll say.
Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal. Oh. Whoa, unreal.
Oh, I wish I hadn't said that name.
The reason for that, of course, is that Eliot is writing about the sense of an order cracking, great yeah. imperial orders, great cities collapsing. And one of the areas of parts of the world where, and it must have informed that, where things are definitely imploding is the Levant. Great cities of Jerusalem, Athens and Alexandria are all embroiled in kind of convulsions in this year. But he also mentions London.
Yeah.
And on the 22nd of June in London, Eaton Square, to be precise, a field marshal called Sir Henry Wilson is shot. And he's shot by two men who had served in the First World War, in the Great War. Yeah. And one of them had actually lost a leg. At Ypres, they shoot Sir Henry Wilson as he's coming back from opening a war memorial at Liverpool Street railway station to the dead of the Great War. And they shoot him because they are members of the IRA.
Yeah, that's absolutely
so they've been
right.
in the British Army, they're now in the Irish Republican Army. And Dominic, this assassination on the streets of London of a guy who was actually Irish, he was... you know, vehemently anti-home rule, anti-Irish independence. The Irish War of Independence had been going on. He was pressing the British government to carry on. He said that the truce that ended the Irish War of Independence was rank, filthy cowardice. And it's unclear, actually, who was behind it. But it has a kind of knock-on effect, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely. It's a landmark in British and Irish history, even though in Britain, pretty much nobody, I imagine, listening to this podcast will remember it. I mean, he's a massive figure. He's the chief of the Imperial General Staff, Sir Henry Wilson. And the cabinet meets that night. They take the revolvers that had shot him, the police, and they put them on the cabinet table. And Lloyd George and Churchill look at these guns and they say, my God, you know, these are the guns that just an hour ago shot Sir Henry Wilson, who they both knew really well. So, and this is the trigger in some ways for the Irish Civil War.
Right.
Breaks out just
but it also exists as a kind of full stop in the process of negotiation that had led to Ireland leaving the Free State, as it becomes, leaving the United Kingdom,
yeah,
and the partition and everything. So just, Dominic, just fill us in on the background of, because a treaty is signed between the United Kingdom and,
yes,
this kind of emergent Irish Free State in 1921. And
that's right.
Whether you accept this treaty or not, if you're Irish, becomes, yeah, a key determinant.
Okay, thanks, Tom. So an Englishman trying to sum up the complexities of Irish politics in the early 20s seconds. What could possibly go wrong?
We've had so many Irish listeners say, why don't you do something on the Irish Civil War? And the reason for that is that
it's your terror.
So I hope Irish listeners will forgive Dominic's summation that he's now about to give.
So ever since the Easter Rising in 1916... and particularly
terrible beauty is born
in the final years of the 1910s and the first years of the 1920s, violence has come to the streets and the countryside of Ireland, as the IRA have been fighting for independence from Britain. And at the end of 1921, to cut a very long story short, the sort of Irish plenipotentiaries who have come to London have agreed a deal. They've been browbeaten partly into agreeing a deal, the Anglo-Irish Treaty, in which basically what was then called Southern Ireland all of Ireland actually will get self-governing status within the British Empire as a dominion, rather like Canada, Australia.
And so still acknowledging the crown.
Yeah. It'll be the Irish Free State. Now, the people who sit in the Doyle will have to swear an oath of allegiance to the king. So the king will still, King George V will still be the king. They'll have to swear an oath of allegiance, which a lot of people don't like. And there's one other element that a lot of people don't like, perhaps they don't, which they know is probably inevitable, which is that Northern Ireland will be given a month to withdraw from the Irish Free State if it wants and stay in the United Kingdom. And everybody knows that Northern Ireland, because of its Protestant population,
yeah,
will make
so that so Catholics choice. Are about 20%. Is that right at that point?
Well, I think possibly slightly more, but yeah, you're right. There are obviously some areas of Northern Ireland that are very strongly Catholic. So a lot of people expect that there'll be some swapping after partition, which actually doesn't happen
in the Levant.
But yes, so basically the treaty is agreed. Now the key thing, which will surprise people who don't know anything about Irish politics, is that the main figure on the Irish side, Eamon de Valera, has not come to London with his men to sign the treaty. And there are all kinds of theories about and speculations about why he doesn't do it. Some people say that basically he doesn't do this for cynical reasons, because he doesn't want to be associated.
Doesn't want to dabble his fingers in the blood of
exactly
compromise.
He knows that they'll have to compromise and he doesn't want to be party to it. So basically what happens is when they bring the treaty back, the key guy, by the way, in negotiating the treaty is a man called Michael Collins.
And has he been the hero of a film?
He's played by Liam Neeson.
Yes, he is.
Tom, can you do a Michael Collins? I will find you and I will kill you. Is it that, or as you would say, I will kill you?
let's reverse. I should never have mentioned this.
If you want to hear Tom's version of Liam Neeson, you should listen to our podcast on the CIA. It's gone down as one of the landmark impersonations in modern cultural history. But anyway, Michael Collins was the head of intelligence for the IRA. He's everybody in the British side says this is a tremendously impressive young man. I mean,
he does look a bit like Liam Neeson, actually.
He does, yes. Yeah, he doesn't look like you. I don't think he looks like you at all.
No.
I don't think you could play I can play Thomas Beckett and Paddington, admittedly, only to a one-star level.
I could play him on a BBC radio drama. Because obviously could, the power of my yes. my accent and voice.
You could. You could.
Would convey.
Are you pitching for work?
I am.
In the centenary production.
What could possibly go wrong?
So anyway, Collins comes back with the treaty. De Valera doesn't like it. So it passes the Doyle, the Irish Parliament. But De Valera, it passes by 7 votes, but De Valera doesn't like it at all. And De Valera actually campaigns against the treaty that his own allies have negotiated. So he basically says the IRA will wade through the blood of the soldiers of the Irish government to get their freedom if necessary. So basically the stage is set for the Sinn Féin and the IRA to fall out among themselves.
Because they're all Sinn Féin.
So yeah. Actually, Ireland has a general election in June, 4 days before the murder of Sir Henry Wilson, where there are two Sinn Féin parties running against each other, one pro-treaty, yeah. one anti-treaty, yeah. and the pro-treaty win. But what's also complicating things is that there's still quite a lot of violence on the ground. And in April, some anti-treaty IRA men have occupied the Four Courts complex in Dublin, which is this big sort of complex of courthouses. As a part of their, they think that by occupying these buildings, they will provoke British reprisals, and that will allow the war. That mean the war
to start up again. Yeah,
and that will unite all the now. So they're there in the Four Courts, and the British have not yet. React. The British haven't reacted for once, unbelievably.
But also, they still have possession of Dublin Castle, I think. They
yes,
still have,
there are still British troops.
It's a
British
military,
garrison.
They've got guns and artillery and all kinds
exactly.
of stuff.
Exactly. So the British are poised, but unbelievably, for once in the entire history of Ireland, the British stay their hands.
They behave with restraint.
Exactly. So normally what happens, and even in the 70s, is the British make absolutely catastrophic decisions and are far too heavy-handed, but... For once, they don't do anything. But that night after Sir Henry, you mentioned Sir Henry Wilson. Sir Henry Wilson is killed. And the British say, okay, we've had enough. They blame this, some people think possibly wrongly, on the men who have taken over the Four Courts complex in Dublin.
Well,
they blame
is it not a possibility that Michael Collins was actually behind
yes, it is.
That he'd
it
given the order but then forgotten about it.
It is a possibility. It's incredibly unclear. Who gave the order to kill Sir Henry
Wilson? Or indeed, if anyone did, that maybe
yeah,
these two
exactly,
men just did it.
Exactly right. Yeah. The British side, Lloyd George and Churchill, who are the kind of prime movers in the governments at this point in their relations with Ireland, they basically say, okay, enough is enough. You know, get your house in order. If you won't kick these guys out of the Four Courts,
we're going to.
We will do it for you. And so on the 28th of June, so that's what, 6 days later, well, they say to the British garrison, it's time for you to act. And actually, the commander of the British garrison.
Yeah, he says, I'm not sure
he
about
says,
that.
I think we should wait and give Collins a chance to do it yeah. first. And so again, then, unbelievably, a British general.
which Collins then does. And you know what, W.B. Yeats, we've had a lot of poetry in this. Yeats, we had Yeats in the episode on the Rubicon. did you see what Yeats, it's quoted it by Kevin Jackson in Constellation Genius, what Yeats said on the morning of the 28th of June?
I don't. You're going to tell me, though.
All is, I think, going well. And the principal, well, I think Yeats spoke like that, didn't he?
I don't know.
All is, I think, going well. And the principal result of this turmoil will be love of order in the people and a stability in the government not otherwise obtainable.
Oh, my God.
Which,
to Yeats for political prognostications.
Yeah, so he's a great poet, but as a political pundit, he's maybe...
He said that on the very morning that the war started.
He said
started.
That on the very morning of the start of the war on the 28th of June when Collins goes in hard against the anti-treaty men.
Yeah. So Collins basically orders the recapture of the Four Courts, and that starts a week of very heavy fighting in Dublin. And then basically the Irish Civil War, the Irish government, so Collins, the pro-treaty forces quite quickly capture all the major towns, so Cork and Waterford and so on. But the guerrilla fighting goes on. And Collins himself is ambushed on the 22nd of August and is killed.
He's killed, yeah.
Outside Cork, in County Cork.
Do you know who else gets shot at in the Irish Civil War?
You're going to tell me.
Who we've mentioned in this podcast yesterday.
We mentioned yesterday. Who did we mention yesterday? Lenin. It was obviously
Irish.
Him.
No, it's Irish.
Is it James Joyce?
It's not James Joyce, but you're in the right ballpark. It's Nora Barnacle. So Joyce's wife by this point, originally from Galway, and she goes with her two children back to Galway. And obviously, she's married to James Joyce, so they're not interested in international politics at all.
Right. They have noticed there's a war.
So she goes to her house in Galway and discovers that it's being used for target practice. So she thinks, oh, I'm not sure about this. So she gets on the train and then people start shooting at the train.
Oh, my word. Man, and Joyce was wise to stay in Zurich.
Yeah, he was. And so she gets to Dublin and goes back to Paris. I think she never gets back to Ireland, I think.
Well, you wouldn't, would you, if you were shot out?
No, I think so. So she has an experience of it.
So it's quite a sort of grim story, all things considered. The death toll, I have to say, by comparison with some of the other death tolls we've been talking about in these 1922 podcasts, it's not massive. I mean, probably more Irish people die in the Civil War than in the War of Independence, oddly. So probably about 2,000 people die. And there are also some pretty horrific killings in Belfast. So there are kind of what people call, perhaps with pardonable exaggeration, they kind of call pogroms of Catholic civilians. So there's a killing of the McMahon family in this, what's called the Arnon Street killings in the spring of 1922. But in general, so about 2,000 people probably die in the Irish War of Independence.
And they're always burning down country houses, aren't
exactly,
they?
Exactly. A lot of country houses are kind of sacked and despoiled and so on. But that actually pales by comparison with what's going on at the same time, which kind of monopolizes a lot of British interest in the Middle East. So,
right.
So although we were talking about Britain being sort of top nation, big empire, there's a constant sense of firefighting and kind of struggling to cope with all these crises, sort of imperial.
And if we're talking about 1922 as a year where the modern world has its foundations, I think that the Near East is really an example, because basically going all the way back to the empire of Cyrus the Great, the Middle East had been multi-ethnic, multicultural, imperial states, whether it's the Persian Empire, Macedonians, Romans, Arabs, Ottomans, and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. It's the end of an era and the beginning of the era that we now live in.
Absolutely. I mean, the Ottoman Empire, when did the Ottomans start? 13th century? But the empire is a successor to Byzantium. You're looking from 1453 onwards. And the Ottoman Empire has been the bulwark of order, I suppose, in the Near East for, as you know, what are we talking? Less than 700 years.
I mean, it's often very brutal. I mean, I think the Yazidis, for instance, would not say that Ottoman imperialism was anything tremendous. Yeah. But it, like all the previous, all the previous great empires, multiculturalism, multi-ethnic cities are just the way things are. So whether it's Alexandria, whether it's Smyrna or Izmir, as the Turks call it, whether it's Constantinople or Istanbul, as it will become, these are great polyglot cities full of merchants from across the Levant, so Greeks and Turks and Jews and Syrians and Egyptians, and they're all mixed up. And what happens in 1922 is that you start to get the population swaps that you don't get in Ireland in this period, where basically the idea of ethnically based nation states or faith based nation states starts to emerge from out of the kind of very, very ancient chrysalis of this idea of the universal empire. And it's a horribly bloody process.
It's extraordinary in some ways that the Ottoman Empire is still a legal entity as late as 22, because they've lost the First World War. The British and French have taken over in the Levant, haven't they?
Yeah.
So the British have been in Palestine, but I think you have a fact, don't you, about the League of Nations only approves the British mandate?
In 1922. And I think that, again, that's really the Balfour Declaration means that the British are they've got the Balfour Declaration and they've got the promise that they've made to various Arab princes.
Yeah.
And they attempt to balance this by, setting up the Hashemite Kingdom, Transjordan, so what will become the Kingdom of Jordan, and allowing Jewish immigration into Palestine. The Jewish population of Palestine grows by 10% year on throughout the 20s. But the fact that this gets rubber stamped by the League of Nations, I think, is actually significant, because Britain, although it's captured Palestine as a result of it, you know, Allenby moving in 1917 in the war, there is a sense that Britain now and all the great powers are answerable to a kind of international standard of behaviour, and that is kind of new, and it's something in a way that you know, if we're talking about Israel-Palestine, has never gone away. The sense that this is a conflict that the United Nations and nations around the world have a massive stake in, a moral stake in, is something that is first signalled in 1922 by the League of Nations giving its imprimatur to the British Mandate.
Yeah, I suppose what you can say is the great European empires are deferring to a sense of kind of international morality, aren't they?
But they're also trying to provide a degree of international supervision to a process of population transfer that is on an absolutely massive scale.
But what happens in Palestine is not what happens in Turkey. So that's the contrast, isn't it? That in Palestine you have this ethnic mix, which is never ironed out, as it were, forcibly. So you still have to this day.
But you are getting a kind of population swap in that you're getting Jews who are coming in and who are starting to buy land up. I mean, it's a very, very slow motion population swap that will obviously be expedited by the events of the Second World War.
But
you don't have the kind of massive instantaneous population swaps that you do get in 1922 between Greeks and Turks.
I mean, that is a story that it's very hard to read without feeling this tremendous sense of kind of loss and tragedy on both sides.
Absolutely. Do you not think? Yeah. Again, you know, we're talking about how old the roots of this order are in the Levant, and there have been Greeks, you know, on the Turkish coast of the Aegean since the time of the Trojan War.
Yeah. I mean, when we did our Alexander the Great podcast, Alexander marching through all these cities, Sardis, Miletus, Halicarnassus. Yeah. And that world is about...
And Constantinople was a Greek-speaking empire.
Yeah.
And all of that is lost. And in a way, the Greeks bring it on themselves. I mean, it's a kind of land grab. They're trying, you know, after they've been on the Allied side, the Turks have lost. And the Greeks say, you know, what we want as our reward is to revive the Byzantine Empire, basically. You know,
I suppose you can see it from...
Of course.
Everything is up for grabs in the collapse of the Ottoman Empire.
But they overreach.
No one knows what's going to happen. The Greeks have invaded.
Yeah.
They have overreached. They've marched.
So in 1922, they get defeated at the Battle of Sakarya, which is the furthest that they get into Anatolia. And they're defeated by Mustafa Kemal, who was the hero for the Turks of Gallipoli.
Yeah.
And he then drives the Greeks back. And the great, great tragedy, horror, atrocity is in September, the burning of Smyrna, Izmir. You know, one of the great, great melting pots of the Mediterranean, which gets absolutely wiped out.
Yeah, about 100,000. I mean, we're talking about death tolls. 100,000 people probably died.
Yeah,
in the sack of Smyrna. So basically, what happens is, as you say, the Greeks have overextended themselves. The Turks pushed them all the way back to Smyrna, and then the Greeks and the entire Greek and Armenian population of Smyrna and all international citizens are on the quayside, basically. And the city is burning, and a lot of them don't have time to get away. And Mustafa Kemal does give orders to his army to restrain themselves, you know, and don't kill any civilians and stuff. But like, as both armies had throughout this war, I mean, it's an incredibly horrible story. Both the Greeks and the Turks had committed endless atrocities against civilians in the course of the war, as is inevitable, I suppose, when you have a war that is driven by a kind of sense of national and ethnic sort of self-affirmation.
And I'm sure that that's what Eliot is kind of alluding to in his image of cities, unreal cities, cracking and reforming and burning.
Well, there's somebody from Smyrna in the wasteland.
Yeah, Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant.
Yeah.
So there are echoes of it throughout the wasteland. But I think, you know, that establishes the geopolitical contours of the Near East.
Of
Greece,
the boundaries of Greece,
of Egypt,
and Turkey. Yeah.
of Israel, of Palestine, that we still have.
But what it also does, Tom, in a way that, in a really surprising link, it helps to create modern British politics.
Okay, so tell me about that.
So this is a really fascinating story. So Mustafa Kemal has taken Smyrna. He has basically taken Ionia, the region that the Greeks wanted in Asia Minor. There's one bit left, and that is Constantinople and the area around Constantinople and eastern Thrace. And that is being occupied by the Allies, by the British and the French. And at the end of September, Mustafa Kemal is closing in on this area. So this is in some ways the last act of the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
He's closing in and the British are there. And Lloyd George and Churchill, who I talked about before with Ireland. So Lloyd George is the Prime Minister. He's the former he's still a Liberal. But he's basically sold out most. He's not a friend of this podcast, I think it's fair to say.
No, Lord George. You're very hostile to him.
He's just basically an absolute, in my mind, an absolutely terrible man who's abandoned.
Hemingway adored him.
Yeah, but Hemingway adored kind of great men, didn't he?
Yeah.
As Churchill did. Lloyd George has abandoned a lot of his old kind of Welsh radicalism. He's become a very establishment figure. He's been Prime Minister too long. He's incredibly corrupt. And they sit there in Downing Street and they say, if the Turks attack, we must go to war. And so two interesting things happen. First of all, they say, we and the Empire will go to war against the Turks. So we'll now, we'll throw Britain. Churchill, who has completely not learned his lesson from Gallipoli.
Yeah, let's have another crack.
Yeah, let's have another go. Worked brilliantly last time. And one interesting thing that happens is that Canada, Mackenzie King, the Canadian Prime Minister, says, they say, just to check, you're all on board with this. And he says, no, I'm absolutely not on board at all. Britain must stop assuming that Canada will just pitch up and throw our men into battle. So that's talking about straws in the wind for the Empire. That's a really, really telling and important moment that Canada is not going to be just an appendage to Britain anymore.
A blank check.
But the second thing is Lloyd George is leading a coalition government. And many of the Tories are absolutely sick of Lloyd George. They think he's corrupt. They think he's dangerous. They think he's would-be a dictator. And they don't want to have a war with Turkey. Lloyd George decides he wants an election. And he wants the election.
And is the election fought around this issue?
No, it's not going to be fought around this issue because it's becoming increasingly clear that nobody really wants this war. But he decides to go for an election anyway. The Tories are due to have a meeting on the 19th of October at the Carlton Club. You know this.
Mm-hmm.
You're a great man for clubs, Tom. St. James's Club, just down from your club, Brooks's. Mm. They're going to have a meeting of all the Tory sort of backbenchers and so on to decide, will they fight the election?
In 1922.
Yeah.
I see where this is going.
The 1922 committee is today the sort of the caucus of Tory backbenchers, and it takes its name ultimately from this moment. So they meet, and their leader, Austin Chamberlain, who is the son of the great Joseph Chamberlain, and who basically is a pale shadow of his father, who models himself on his father and orchid in his buttonhole, he says, well, we should absolutely back Lloyd George. He's a tremendous fellow and all the rest of it. And now, finally making his podcast debut, one of the great men of history, the Midlands' own Stanley Baldwin.
Hey!
He stands up and says, no, we shouldn't fight it with Lloyd George as the leader. Lloyd George is a dynamic force, and a dynamic force is a terrible thing.
That's very Balfour.
The Tories vote.
Did I say Balfour? I apologise for that.
What did you say?
I said Balfour.
Balfour. How could you do that?
Sorry.
He makes his appearance in the podcast and you mistake him for Arthur Balfour.
I ruin it. I'm so sorry.
Baldwin helps to carry the day. The Tories agree to leave the coalition. Austin Chamberlain is out as the Tory leader. And the unknown prime minister, as he's later called, Bonar Law, born in Canada, Scottish extraction, self-made man, he comes in as Tory leader and there's going to be a general election. And the 1922 general election is one of the absolute landmark British general elections. So it happens in November, the day after the first radio broadcast. And I think to general surprise, the Tories win a massive victory. They win 344 seats. The Liberals, who had been the party of government taking Britain into the Great War, they're nowhere because they're divided between Asquith and Lloyd George. So Asquith gets 62 seats, Lloyd George gets 53. The Liberals are split, doomed, destroyed by the electoral system.
And it is another party coming another up on party. The left flank.
It is the Labour Party, which has never before been one of the top two parties, comes second under its leader, J.R. Clines. Now, J.R. Clines is utterly forgotten. I've never heard of him. I would bet that of the listeners to this podcast, of the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of listeners to this podcast, none but a handful will have heard of J.R. Clines. So he's from Lancashire. He's an Irish background. He went to work in cotton mills at the age of 11, learned the Bible and Shakespeare and Milton by heart.
Great.
He is a man.
That's the kind of Labour leader we want.
He is the kind of Labour leader you like. And he leads them to 142 seats. And from this point onwards, I mean, there are going to be two more elections in the next 2 years, but ultimately from this point onwards, British politics will become a fight between a middle class and Tory party that wins maybe one in four working class votes and a Labour party that wins the other working class votes and the kind of old high-minded kind of bohemian types who had voted Liberal in the past.
This is the strange death of Liberal England.
This is the death of Liberal England. But the great commentator on politics in this period, Tom, you know who the great commentator on British politics in this period is?
Is it? Yes, I do know, and I'm not going to spoil it. So you tell me, Dominic. Yeah.
So he says, they put it this way. There are four sorts of people trying to get to be rulers. They all want to make things better, but they want to make them better in different ways. There's conservatives, and they want to make things better by keeping them just like what they are now. And there's liberals, and they want to make things better by altering them just a bit, but not so that anyone would notice. And there's socialists, and they want to make things better by taking everyone's money off them. And there's communists, and they want to make things better by killing everyone but themselves. And you know who that is?
Just William.
It is. Well, it's William Brown's friend, Henry, who is the brain box of the gang, the Outlaws. And Just William, a lot of British listeners to this podcast will know, he is the ultimate naughty schoolboy. And he's created in 1922 by the writer Richmond Crompton, very conservative novelist. And she writes these stories for women's magazines, and they become tremendously popular and end up selling millions and millions of copies.
I've kept Martin Jarvis
in work
for the rest of his life. He does the brilliant audio books of them.
And William is an absolutely tremendous, and the stories, he's a tremendous creation. The stories are the most brilliant viewpoint, sort of window into the everyday anxieties of kind of middle England in the 1920s and 1930s. They're full of all these sort of do-gooders and League of Nations enthusiasts and prohibitionists who are always moving into the house next door and trying to get William involved in their schemes. Mm. And William always undermines their schemes and destroys them, and it ends up with all the boys having a massive fight.
They're great. Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our tour of 1922. And Dominic, you have completely convinced me that the modern world began. There is just one last question.
Yes, what it's going to be. I know exactly what it's going to be.
So it's from a friend of the show and a titan of tech. Would you like to read it out?
It's from Mark Andreessen, who I think is the co-inventor. I think he would say co-inventor. We'll call him the inventor.
The inventor.
Of the web browser. Netscape. And he says, how long did the modern world actually last? I nominate approximately 1965, but I'm curious what you guys think. 1965 is quite a good call, I think. I mean, it depends how you're defining modernity, doesn't it? I mean, would you end in...
Well, Mark Andreessen he knows his tech.
Yeah.
And I'm not qualified to judge on that. But I would have thought that actually the continuity between, say, radio and the internet is kind of recognisably...
So you think there's a continuity?
I do think there's a continuity.
You don't think the arrival of the kind of microprocessor or something is a...
I think it sped up the trends that were already there. And I think that Hollywood is you know, BBC, that a lot of the cultural trends are cultural and technological trends. I think they modernity does carry through. I think the idea of modernism is dead.
I agree with that. Because it gets replaced by
postmodernism, doesn't it? Yeah. And it is in 1965. So... the idea that there is a kind of great tradition that you can trace through is gone. And we live in a post-modern world. But
see, I would probably agree with you about that, Tom. I think that, let's say you're talking about in terms of tech. And in terms of kind of popular culture, I think what you definitely have from the 1920s through to probably the round about the 1980s, 1990s, is you have a kind of monopoly of culture and a monopoly of technology. So, for example, in Britain, the BBC basically create, and I would say create, a national mass culture for the first time, a sort of a recognisably modern national mass culture where people in completely different parts of the country are watching and listening to the same things, sharing the same cultural references, where there is a unified national kind of cultural vocabulary and so on. And with something like Hollywood, you have the same thing. So you can, you know, if you've seen Star Wars in 1977, yeah, everybody else has seen it too. If you've seen Gone with the Wind,
yeah,
everybody else has seen it. That doesn't exist anymore. We have a much more fragmented culture, yeah, that has moved away. The gatekeepers are gone. The, yeah, monopolies are generally
completely
gone.
And I think also there's a kind of ideological suspicion of that kind of culture. So, yeah, I mean, both Ulysses and The Wasteland depend on a shared culture that people will recognize.
On a canon, because they're engaging on a canon, with a canon.
On a canon.
Yeah.
Whereas now that the very idea of a canon is regarded as oppressive and white, yes, supremacist and yeah, so on. And in that sense, modernism, you know, is, rather than being the kind of the gravedigger of that idea of a canon and a great tradition and the, you know, that line of what would now be called dead white European males,
yeah,
handing out great works, is kind of the last hurrah for that tradition.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And obviously, you take something like the BBC, began in 1922. The BBC is not an antidote to the canon. It absolutely enshrines the canon, yeah, produces endless iterations of it, but is now, in 2022... being left behind by the fragmentation,
yeah,
of global culture. The other thing I suppose I would say is so much of what we talked about is about the Russian Revolution, the reaction to the Russian Revolution and the rise of communism, the idea of a struggle, a titanic struggle between communism and capitalism. That runs right through politics from the early 1920s to the end of the 1980s and then disappears pretty much.
Well, of course, the other thing that's changed, and again, I think this idea that the modernity of 1922 does kind of end, is that in this, we've done two episodes, haven't talked about China, haven't talked about India,
yeah,
haven't really, yeah, talked about Japan, haven't talked about Africa.
Yeah.
You know, there are, we now live, we can talk about 1922 from an almost exclusively American and European perspective. And that may reflect, you know, the blinkered, our blinkered perspective, but I don't think it does entirely. I think it reflects the fact that this was still a world that was ordered by,
yeah,
the European powers and by America, and you do have Japan kind of emerging in the distance, but that's no longer the case. We now live in a multipolar world that would have been unimaginable to people in 1922.
Yeah, I suppose, Tom, 100 years from now, will 1922 seem important? Maybe it won't, because the focus will have changed so much.
Yeah, I think
so. The British,
true,
Empire will seem such a relic. Joyce and Eliot will no longer seem like,
yeah,
huge cultural titanic figures in the way, yeah, that they do now.
Well, I'm not sure they even do now. I mean, I think that particularly Eliot is regarded with high suspicion.
Do you think so?
Yes, as a kind of, you know, reactionary conservative. And,
yeah.
And even Joyce is...
He hasn't been cancelled, surely.
No, he hasn't been cancelled, but you know, he's a dead white European male.
He is, it's true.
So, who knows?
However, I think what will be remembered, and rightly, what will be rehabilitated, is that landmark performance that you talked about at the beginning of the podcast.
The one star,
the
review.
See, I thought we had two stars.
No, I'm afraid, you know what? I'm going to post that review on Twitter.
I'm going to post that review on Twitter
so that people can see that I'm not lying.
I think your newspaper copy's just faded or something. I'm sure there were two stars.
Well, I'll post it and listeners can judge for themselves.
Let's hope.
And you know what else? Where else I'll post it? I will post it on the Discord chat.
Oh, very good. For Rest is History Club members.
Yes. And I might also post some other things that Rebecca sent.
Oh, what?
There are your playbill and your poster,
oh, right,
and all kinds of things.
Do I look good in it?
You look fabulous. I'm going to post that exclusively on the Discord. So if you want to see those, you're going to
Club
join
members.
The Rest of History
I mean, I'm worried
Club.
That's actually a disincentive. But actually, on the incentive front, just one quick reminder, you will get, if you join the Rest is History Club, bonus episodes.
Restishistorypod.com.
You get bonus episodes, you get a live stream, you get ad-free episodes, access to the archive, you get all these kind of goodies. And if enough people join, of course, we never need to promote it again on the podcast, and everybody will breathe
that's true
an
as well.
Enormous sigh of relief.
And we're doing our next live episode, we're doing on reputations, aren't we?
Yes, on historical reputations.
We haven't quite fixed a date for that, but it will be next week or so. And that will be on reputations, how they evolve, how they change, who goes up, who goes down.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the people we've talked about on these episodes.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, Churchill is a classic example. Anyway, we shall deal with this in due course. So thank you so much for listening. Have a very happy 2022. Let's hope it works out rather better for us all than 1922 did.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.